From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
They have to create a new Yugoslavia, a new federation of all the people of the Balkans that are determined to live together in peace and keep the violent superpowers based upon greed and corporate capital interests out of their turf.
The air war intensifies. We'll bring you the voices of anti-war protesters over the weekend. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yugoslav commanders last night held up agreement over the terms of their forces' retreat from Kosovo, delaying further NATO and diplomatic action to end the 76-day conflict. The Yugoslav delegation was still refusing to sign a six-page document setting out routes and a timetable for the Serb retreat. Early today, after an adjournment of several hours, talks resumed between the Yugoslav team and General Sir Michael Jackson of Britain, who is to lead NATO's peacekeeping force into Kosovo under the agreement accepted last week by Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. In anticipation of an imminent start to the Serb pullout, foreign ministers of major Western powers and Russia are to meet today in Bonn to draft a United Nations Security Council resolution on a peace accord. Sergei Stepashin, the Russian prime minister, called for a speedy UN resolution, but complained, quote, many issues are still being resolved on purely NATO terms. Last night, a NATO diplomat said Yugoslav commanders meeting with Allied officers in Macedonia were objecting to letting in peacekeepers unless the United Nations Security Council first authorized them, a condition that some allies view as unacceptable. The attempt to bar the peacekeeping force without Security Council approval struck at the weakest link in the recent chain of events that the Allies were counting on to result in a victory. The United States and Britain had agreed with France, Germany, and other European allies that the peacekeeping force should have the Security Council's authorization. But American and British officials said that if approval was delayed and Serbs were withdrawing troops, NATO should be ready to move in to prevent a vacuum. France and most of the European allies did not see things that way, and neither did Russia. Western diplomats hoped that Russia would approve a Security Council resolution sending in peacekeepers regardless of whether Milosevic wanted them under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. Russia had said it might also join the peacekeeping force on its own terms. The world's fourth most populous country, Indonesia, freed from the grip of its longtime dictator, marked a new era of political freedom today with its first free election in four decades. That's the way the New York Times describes today's elections. We'll be speaking with journalist Alan Nairn in Indonesia later in the show to get a different perspective. The World Bank is close to endorsing a $3.5 billion oil field and pipeline project linking wells in Chad to Cameroon's Atlantic coast. If its board gives the go-ahead, the bank would lend $190 million and assemble $300 million in commercial bank loans for the Central African project. The venture's lead private sponsor, Exxon, said World Bank support is essential for its continued participation in the project, which is opposed by environmental and human rights activists. Senior bank staff have decided to back the project, and in a private meeting recently, World Bank President James Wolfensohn told environmentalists that he's leaning toward the staff position. If he gives his approval, the loan could go to the board around mid-September. The group of seven leading industrial countries are struggling to agree a new debt relief package for poor countries, with Japan fiercely resisting any proposals for much greater generosity. The G7, which also includes Canada, Germany, France, and Italy, has been urged by smaller countries and the World Bank to back any new debt relief proposals with money to pay for them. They fear the G7 will claim the political credit for any initiative while leaving others to pick up the bill. Debt campaign groups are already expressing disappointment at the G7's efforts. Jubilee 2000, which has mobilized high-profile support from entertainers for events such as last weekend's Debt Wish Live comedy show in London, predicts that the outcome will provide less than $3 per person each year. The Connecticut House of Representatives has passed a bill to outlaw racial profiling and require police departments to keep track of the race and ethnicity of the drivers they pull over. The bill, which passed late on Friday on a 120-25 vote, now heads to the state Senate, which already passed a similar measure and is expected to approve this one. Supporters of the bill say the measure is needed to assure drivers they will not be pulled over because of their race, ethnicity, age, or sex. And finally, the Reverend Al Sharpton demanded this weekend that New Jersey authorities release the police videotape showing how police officers ended up firing 27 bullets at an unarmed motorist. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our daily War and Peace Report continues. I'm Amy Goodman. A sonic boom sounded in Belgrade today for the first time in 2 days after talks in Macedonia on the withdrawal of Yugoslav troops from Kosovo broke down early in the morning. NATO, which has focused its attacks on Kosovo rather than on the rest of Serbia since Belgrade agreed to an international peace plan on Thursday, has threatened to intensify its airstrikes against Yugoslavia if the military does not withdraw. NATO flew almost 500 air missions on its 75th day of bombings. Yugoslavia confirmed today that it wants a UN Security Council resolution before any foreign troops enter Kosovo. This is now one of the major stumbling blocks to a resolution of the conflict. Meanwhile, Russia said today it's deeply concerned by growing demands from NATO in the Kosovo crisis and by the alliance's failure to halt the bombing of Yugoslavia. We now go to Belgrade to Pacifica reporter Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us what is happening at this moment in Belgrade, as we have just learned about the intensification of the air war?
Well, that's right, Amy. No one is holding their breath here thinking that the bombing is going to end anytime soon. As you reported, air raid sirens did sound in the capital, Belgrade, as well as in 15 or 16 other cities around the country. They did attack targets and other areas around Belgrade last night. And in fact, when the talks did break off yesterday, General Michael Jackson, who would lead the forces in Kosovo once NATO were to occupy the Serbian territory, he said after the talks broke out, quote, "NATO has no other choice but to continue and intensify its campaign until Yugoslavia is ready for total and unconditional implementation of the Kosovo plan." And that's exactly what we saw today and late last night, was a resumption of the bombing that seemed to have lulled in most parts of Serbia the past couple of days. They have continued their campaign in Kosovo. They killed 5 civilians last night in extensive bombing raids over Kosovo. Now, it's interesting to note how this has been covered by the media here in Belgrade. Studio B, which is a television station run by the opposition Serbian Renewal Movement, headed by Vuk Drašković, they're considered Belgrade City TV, which is Belgrade is run by the opposition primarily on a local level. They reported accurately that indeed there were talks going on between Yugoslav generals and NATO generals. However, state-run TV, Radio Television Serbia, reported only that Yugoslav representatives were meeting with, quote, UN experts. That also is the coverage in Politica, the state-controlled daily here. So there's a difference in what people understand is actually happening in Macedonia. There are very, very serious disagreements going on down there, according to sources that we've talked to in the government here and other independent analysts, and many of them are the same disagreements that have been consistent throughout this discussion. What is the composition of the force going to look like? Who's going to lead that force? And how is the process of withdrawing Serb troops and implementing NATO troops going to take place? Now, there are 4 main theories as to what caused or what is causing the breakdown in the talks. The first, which seems least likely, is that Slobodan Milosevic has no intention of pulling out of Kosovo and that he's merely stalling for a temporary lull in the bombing, hoping that NATO would find it difficult to re-escalate its campaign with the international opposition to the strikes growing, etc. This theory also says that he may be trying to buy time for the UN Security Council resolution that Yugoslavia and Russia have been pushing for. Now, the second theory is that there is a minor split between Milosevic and generals over his apparent capitulation to NATO's demands. That seems unlikely, as independent analysts say very much that the police and the military are still very, very loyal to Milosevic. But there are some loyalists within the military to Vojislav Šešelj, the leader of the Serbian Radical Party, which is against the agreement. And so that may be a factor, but it seems not as likely as the final two. And that is that there is a genuine disagreement between Yugoslavia and NATO on the terms of the agreement, of the Chernomyrdin-Ahtisaari-Milosevic agreement, and more importantly, interpreting how that will be implemented. Also, the final is that NATO is refusing, as it did at Rambouillet, to set reasonable terms for the Yugoslav delegation in an effort to maintain justification for the strikes. Now, those last two are probably what is really at issue in these discussions. The Yugoslav delegation is refusing to accept NATO's plan for withdrawal. That plan, according to analysts, calls for NATO troops moving in within 24 hours of Yugoslav troops moving out. A Yugoslav side wants a security resolution, as I said, that clearly defines the terms of this withdrawal. They're concerned about NATO troops moving in. They're concerned about KLA forces stepping up their attacks on Yugoslav and Serb military as well as civilians, and they say they're going to need 2 weeks. Now, NATO is saying, no, it has to be 7 days, at the most 8 days.
Jeremy, there was a very interesting piece in the New York Times on Saturday, and I was wondering what your take on this is. We have been talking extensively about the Rambouillet Accord, what many in the peace movement call the Rambouillet Accord, and the question of whether it was presented knowing that the bar was too high for the Serbs to accept. We had George Kenney on last week, who is a former State Department official, who said he had on very reliable sources that a high-level State Department person had said exactly that at Rambouillet. But in Stephen Erlanger's piece in the New York Times, he says the key part of the proposal that made it acceptable for Belgrade, the Yugoslav officials say, was the limitation on the movement of the international forces, mostly NATO and Russian troops, under a UN flag to Kosovo itself. Under an annex of the Rambouillet Accord, a purely NATO force was to be given full permission to go anywhere it wanted in Yugoslavia, immune from any legal process. But what his point was what Yugoslav officials are saying in this agreement, they would be limited to Kosovo itself. As well, he points out that in the latest accord, it says that there would not be a reexamination of Kosovo's sovereignty after 3 years or any referendum on that topic, as the Rambouillet agreement had said and laid out. And what he was suggesting, if the Yugoslav officials are right, and we haven't really seen the full text of this agreement, was that, in fact, it was the West and NATO that had backed down, that Milosevic had not accepted the Rambouillet text now. And this is extremely significant if this is the case, because if what they're saying is true, if presented more than 74 days ago with this proposal, it may be Milosevic would have accepted it before the bombing.
Yeah, and that's the sense of a lot of people here. I mean, the main question a lot of people are asking is, if we're getting essentially a similar deal to Rambouillet, why did we suffer for 11 straight weeks of heavy and intensive bombardment that hit away at the civilian infrastructure in the country here? I mean, the sentiment on the part of people here is that it is worse than Rambouillet, because everyone knows that the Yugoslav side could not have accepted Rambouillet under any conditions. I've talked to reporters here who were at Rambouillet and said the same thing that Kenny wrote in The Nation and said on Democracy Now, that the bar was intentionally set high so that it could provide the context for what we're now seeing, basically a total occupation of Kosovo. And in years to come, who knows where else those troops would intend to go. Now, it's interesting that the talks broke off early this morning at around 2:30 a.m. local time here, with the Yugoslav side refusing to sign any document. But before the talks broke out, Russia's military attaché went from Belgrade to Macedonia, and he said that it was an unexpected demand by NATO for a simultaneous withdrawal of Serb forces along with the introduction of NATO troops. And he reminded NATO generals that under the Chernomyrdin-Ahtisaari-Milosevic agreement that was adopted by the Serb parliament, the so-called international operation can start only after a relevant UN Security Council resolution was passed. Now, this is going to prove to be a very significant divide, the Russia-NATO divide, on the key questions of implementation. You have the composition of the force. What is Russia's role going to be in that? The nature of the Serb troop withdrawals. How is that going to happen? How do they ensure the security of these forces? But also the NATO occupation's issue of command structure. Russia said yesterday, in the form of Viktor Chernomyrdin, that they will never be under NATO's command and that it's out of the question. And he reiterated that Russia, like Yugoslavia, is calling for a UN resolution and an immediate halt to the bombing. That seems very unlikely at this point, especially if the talks break down once again.
But I just wanted to make this distinction. I understand what you're saying, that people are very angry that this was accepted in Yugoslavia. And if it was the same thing as a Rambouillet text, why did they have to undergo all this bombing? Why didn't Milosevic accept it to begin with? But this is a distinction here. And this distinction is that the actual text has been changed and that now they're talking about NATO limited to Kosovo, but that it would be under a UN force, something that the Serb parliament originally said they'd agree to before the bombing, and that Kosovo's independence would not be reconsidered in 3 years. The possibility that it was changed so that Milosevic would accept it and that the West had backed down.
Right. I mean, and that's all very much on paper. I mean, people are aware of that here. It is something that's being talked about. But they also point out that the United States and other NATO countries have very little, if any, respect for the UN structures, that Chapter 7 was violated, et cetera. So what it says on paper may have been to entice Milosevic's signing of the deal versus at Rambouillet, where the language was very different. And that may have been why they changed that. But for the real situation, the actual situation on the ground, people don't believe that it's going to be under UN auspices. They feel very much that whatever flag supposedly is flying over those troops, they are going to be under NATO control.
Let me ask you something else. A lot of what's in the papers here in the United States is that perhaps Milosevic is stalling so that he can his troops can burn bodies. Yesterday, Newsday, the front page was a person, a Kosovar Albanian, saying he saw bodies piled up and that they were burning them to get rid of evidence so that people wouldn't be charged with war crimes, that Pristina was being pillaged and raided before the Serb forces leave. Is there any discussion of that there? Is this information that you hear there?
Yeah, I mean, I do hear it, and I think that some people that have access to independent information also hear it. And there is a concern on the ground among Serbians in Belgrade here of what is happening in Kosovo. And I would say that concern is increasing as the reports increase and a lot more voices are surfacing that are expressing concern over the fate of the Kosovar Albanians. Many people here feel that they are caught between two evil sides: the Serb forces that are attacking and the KLA forces that are attacking. Now, some people would put varying degrees of responsibility on who is actually responsible for the humanitarian catastrophe there. But there are people in Belgrade who are very, very concerned about what's happening to the Kosovar Albanians. We hadn't heard those reports in Belgrade, at least I hadn't, about that being a reason for the stalling. What we heard as a reason for the stalling was to buy time for the UN Security Council to meet, something that not only Yugoslavia is calling for, but Russia as well. And that has been more the dominant spin of people analyzing why the push for a pause in the bombing has taken place.
Finally, Jeremy, we're going to play some speeches from a major protest this weekend at the Pentagon. There were protests all over the world. Did you hear about them in Belgrade?
Absolutely, Amy. They showed footage of it here on not only the local television stations, but we did see it on some other international stations as well. It did receive coverage in the print media here also. People are aware that thousands of people in the United States did, in fact, march at the Pentagon. And I think that there was a sense of joy and solidarity with activists in the United States that they didn't feel that this agreement meant that this thing is over. As we've said repeatedly on Democracy Now!, even if the bombs stop falling, the country will continue to suffer for years and years to come. We are in the beginning stages, as Thomas Gumbleton has said and as others have said, we're in the beginning stages of a humanitarian disaster, a crisis like we've seen in Iraq. Now, I just wanted to add one thing, Amy, before we go.
We have 20 seconds.
That is that we should think of what's going to happen with the Serbian military during this withdrawal. What are they going to return to? No paychecks, empty barracks. The greatest loser in this could turn out to be the Yugoslav armed forces.
And finally, Milosevic, do you have a sense that people will rise up against him or that the Serbs are united with him because of the bombing of their country?
After being here, Amy, for about 3 weeks, I would say that the Serbs, quote-unquote, are not united under Milosevic or with Milosevic. They're united with their country. I think the disgust for Milosevic has increased dramatically since this began. They hold him accountable along with NATO for this bombing. One thing that we could see happen, though, is Milosevic reordering the government, where he brings in people like Vuk Drašković from the Serbian Renewal Movement, who is a, you know, somewhat of a Milosevic loyalist, though he gives the appearance of being an opposition leader. He could pull those so-called opposition forces closer into the fold and sort of resell his government to people. But I don't think people are going to buy that. I think that we will see in the months to come a real opposition to business as usual in Yugoslavia. There is an opposition that's forced underground, but they won't take it forever.
Thank you very much, Jeremy Scahill, reporting to us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia. We'll be back with him tomorrow, and we will be turning to the protests of this weekend next. Stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Killers at Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers at Butare must be sanitary workers. The savages at Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram, in the new world order. Like a dirty old bandage upon the festering face of humanity. The old order unravel and reveal. Old scar just a broke out in a new soul. Primeval wound that time won't heal, and in the ancient currency of blood, tribal tyrants are set to world score. The killers at Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers at Butare must be sanitary workers. The savages at Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram, in the new world order. And it's the same old Cain and Abel syndrome, far more ancient than the fall of Rome. But in the new world...
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of people marched on Washington this weekend, beginning at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and then walking into Virginia to the Pentagon, where rallies were held on both ends. This in addition to protests around the world, from hundreds of demonstrators throwing stones at the U.S. Embassy in Prague and saying no to NATO, protests in Italy at the Aviano Air Base and San Francisco, where we heard that the only mention of the protests in the mainstream media was advisory, travel advisories, not to travel on certain streets in San Francisco, Toronto, Montreal, as well as Greece, Amsterdam, and other places. Today, we're going to bring you two speeches from this weekend's demonstration, beginning with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who has been to Yugoslavia twice since the bombing began.
We must never forget that Yugoslavia was founded on an idea. And the idea was that all the peoples of the southern Slavs, with all their cultural differences, their national origins, their ethnic origins, their religious histories, could live together in peace. That was the idea of Yugoslavia. And from World War I to World War II, they lived together with less violence than at any time before that. And from World War II until almost 1990, they lived with the greatest stability and peace and prosperity of any time in their history in these last centuries. And the United States determined to demolish Yugoslavia. And it acted systematically over a period of more than 15 years to accomplish it. It began supporting ethnic cleansing in Kosovo in the early 1980s. We should never forget that. You can look it up again in the New York Times from 1981, 1982. After the riots at Pristina University, more than 20,000 Serbs were purged from Kosovo. And it was clear that the whole purpose at that time was to make that an entirely Muslim state. And that was only the beginning. More than 150,000 were purged from there. From the rest of Yugoslavia, from the republics to the north, More than 1.5 million Serbs were purged. 600,000 from Krajina alone. Purged. Cleansed, if you want to put it that way. I don't think it's cleansing. I think it's purging. And we know who directed it. The United States government directed it. Read Richard Holbrooke's book about how to end the war by killing everybody. And you'll see that we directed the purging of the Serbs from Krajina. Watch what the International Monetary Fund did. Beginning in 1989, 1990, with its strict requirements on free trade, on debt repayment, on incurrence of new debt, on privatization, it brought the economy down for 2 years. And still, the republics, all six of them, were determined to hold together. Then in May of 1991, Secretary of State James Baker cut off all U.S. aid to the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And he said the United States will veto any international loans from the IMF or the World Bank or any other institution over which we have any influence to the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And that began the real breakup. Slovenia withdrew with the encouragement of European neighbors. Croatia withdrew with the encouragement of European neighbors. Bosnia withdrew in a bloody mess that was caused by the United States policies and European neighbors. Macedonia withdrew in a policy that was enforced by the United States. The 25 million people that were Yugoslavs in 1990 numbered 12 million by 1995, and they had become the most segregated people in the history of the Balkans. Just look at Bosnia. Three states, totally segregated. We had never had segregation like this in the United States in the South. There was never segregation and apartheid in South Africa like this. You got three separate states manipulated so they can never live together. One Muslim, one Croatian, Roman Catholic, and one Serb Orthodox. And the determination is that they shall not live together. And now you're taking Kosovo away if you can. And you've declared war on the people of Yugoslavia and committed crimes against peace, the worst crime of all, the first crime in the Nuremberg Charter, the crime against peace. We ended peace in that region with absolutely ruthless, devastating, brutish bombing against a totally defenseless people. It's worse than cowardly to do that. It is murder, and we know it. And everyone responsible in any way for the release of any of those bombs is implicated in murder, and they know it. We also violated the Nuremberg prohibitions of war crimes. We have committed, I've been trying to count them, and I can't keep the count. It keeps going on and on. The direct targeting of civilians is absolutely prohibited. You think we haven't been targeting civilians? That's all we've been hitting. Go there and look. But if you think they can deny it, how do they deny it when they say, look, we're now targeting the friends of President Milosevic, you know? Who are they? They're civilians, for God's sake. You're killing people that have power. You're killing people indiscriminately. You're killing civilians. You're destroying civilian facilities. You're destroying facilities on which civilian life and all life depends. Electricity and water and transportation, communication. You're bombing relentlessly and brutishly and savagely, and you know it. You're destroying the environment for how long? How much depleted uranium is there? How dare we use bombs, fragmentation bombs, against hospitals, and yet we've seen it in three separate hospitals in one trip. Cluster bombs. There has to be accountability. There has to be accountability. In a just world, we know that President Clinton and Prime Minister Blair and their secretaries of state and foreign ministry, Albright and the guy from UK, which happily escapes my mind at the moment. I hope I can keep it that way. I'm talking about the foreign minister, Robin Cook, yeah, who somebody shouldn't have reminded me. They're responsible, but everybody in the chain of command to the pilots who released the bombs are responsible. How does what they differ do from the GI veteran who apparently blew up the Oklahoma Federal Building in Oklahoma City, the Almira Building, or the kids in the high school in Columbine outside of Denver? It's the same thing. You hate and you kill without restriction. You believe you can get in those big planes after your fine college education and all the money they're paying you, and you can just go over there and drop your bombs anyway and kill. We've got to stop that bombing now and forever. We've got a lot of work to do. The U.S. military budget is $300 billion. The budget for that building over there, $300 billion. Until we cut that by 90%, there's going to be brutal war, and we know it. We've got to stop that budget and end the fueling of the flames of war conducted by the United States. We've got to abolish NATO. It has no legal purpose. It has shown itself to be a relentless killing machine. It's comprised of the former colonial powers. How do you like that? These are the same people that brutalized Africa and brutalized Asia and brutalized the Western Hemisphere. Killed the people, didn't care about their lives. They are rich. They are Caucasian. They are Christian. They are high tech, and they don't mind killing everybody indiscriminately. That's what they've shown they'll do. We've got to abolish NATO. It is a threat to life on Earth. We have to recognize among the crimes committed is the evisceration of the United Nations. When we went into this business, we destroyed the United Nations. Unless we can bring it back to existence, it's going to take artificial respiration and a lot more. It's got to be funded. It's got to be respected, because we seized the power of war from the United Nations, which was created to end the scourge of war. And nothing will stop us if we can't get all the people back together to prevent these superpowers from attacking life everywhere. We've got to come to grips with the media. We have to realize how it demonizes, how it portrays Kosovo as a human rights situation in which we are helping. Well, you go to Kosovo and look at it. The heart of Pristina is destroyed. We've killed more Muslims. We've killed more Orthodox Christians. We've killed more Roman Catholic Christians by far than the Serbs have, let me tell you, all over Kosovo and throughout Serbia. And we've destroyed their economy for a long, long time. And ending the bombing, which has to happen immediately, is only the beginning. Because now we'll want to put sanctions on them, don't you know? And don't you know that the sanctions have killed 10 times more people in Iraq than 42 days of bombing and 110,000 aerial sorties compared to 33,000 against Yugoslavia? And it's killed 1.5 million people. There cannot be sanctions against Yugoslavia. Now, they have to be off. There cannot be reparations from Yugoslavia. Europe and the United States have to provide reparations for the Balkans. And then they have to conceive with the people there. They have to create a new Yugoslavia, a new Southern Slavs, a new federation of all the people of the Balkans that are determined to live together in peace and keep the violent superpowers based upon greed and corporate capital interests out of their turf. God bless you, and keep the faith and keep the struggle going.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark speaking Saturday at the Pentagon, where thousands gathered to protest the U.S. NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. Also there was Gordon Clark, Executive Director of Peace Action. He was also part of a demonstration on Thursday that began outside the closed Yugoslav embassy, where a statement was made denouncing ethnic cleansing, then march over to the White House, where he and 25 other people were arrested, including Bishop Thomas Gumbelton of Detroit. Gordon Clark at the Pentagon protest on Saturday.
You know, we were talking to a journalist yesterday who was asking us why we're going to be here today. After all, the war is over. And it reminded me of the story of the famous American writer, environmentalist, and anti-war activist Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau, who, when he protested the Mexican War and was taken to jail for not paying taxes to that war, and his friend, the writer Emerson, came to him in jail and said, "Thoreau, what are you doing in there?" And he replied, "No." He says, "What are you doing out there?" So we are in the right place here today, everyone, and it's great to see you all. You know, they're talking about victory now. And I just wanted to say, as an earlier speaker said today, the reason we are here today is because we are now serving as the conscience of this nation. We are here to remind Americans of a few essential facts. Essential facts which I believe many of them know, but which have been driven into their subconscious by a relentless war machine. While they talk about victory now in the White House and the Pentagon, we are here to remind America that this war is not a victory, that this war has been a monumental failure. As a result of this war, we now have a million refugees whose fate is far from certain. We have thousands of dead Serbian civilians and Kosovo Albanian civilians. We have destroyed a civilian infrastructure in Yugoslavia. We have undermined the United Nations. We have violated international law. We have violated U.S. law, and we've fractured relationships with two nuclear powers, China and Russia. Is this what President Clinton calls victory? Is this what we call victory? There was indeed a civil war going on in Yugoslavia before NATO arrived. A terrible civil war that had ethnically targeted violence, that had terrorism. But we have taken that civil war, and with our larger war, we have created an international catastrophe. We are here today to remind America that there is such a thing as international law, and the Geneva Conventions, and the United Nations, and that NATO, meaning, of course, the United States — no one really talks about the credibility of Holland when they talk about NATO — that NATO does not have the right to take international law into its own hands and decide when and where the cataclysm of war will be visited upon an innocent people. We are here today to remind America that destroying a civilian infrastructure, which is what we are doing in Yugoslavia, that depriving people of electricity, of their jobs, of their water supply, is a direct and flagrant violation of the Geneva Conventions, a war crime, and a moral abomination. We are here today to remind America that a nation which wants to be a force for human rights in the world should first stop its own systematic military support for human rights abusing governments around the world. And if the United States wants to speak for human rights, the first thing it can do is stop the shipment of U.S. weapons and military support to Turkey, Colombia, Indonesia, Mexico, and all the other governments that are using U.S. weapons in wars against civilians. We are here today to remind America that it is wildly inappropriate, counterproductive, and again, immoral to punish an entire civilian population for the sins of its leaders. And I, for one, am sick and tired of having the likes of Madeleine Albright or the talking heads of this country dictate to me that to be pro-Serbian means I support the policies of Milosevic. And I want to be absolutely clear. I want to be absolutely clear that I am adamantly pro-Serbian and I am adamantly anti-Milosevic. That I am adamantly pro-Kosovo Albanian, and I am adamantly anti-Kosovo Liberation Army. And that we as a movement are pro-Serbian, and we are pro-Kosovo Albanian, and that's exactly why we are opposed to this immoral, illegal, and insane war. We are here to remind Americans that you cannot stop killing by performing more killing, that you cannot stop war crimes by committing more war crimes, that you cannot sponsor respect for international law by violating international law. We are here today, finally, we are here today to remind America what Dr. Martin Luther King taught us 30 years ago, and which many of us have forgotten, that the bombs which are dropping today in Serbia, the bombs which are being dropped today are exploding not just in Kosovo and Serbia, but they are exploding right here in America. And if we want to know why some American school children are amassing large arsenals of bombs and guns and other weapons, and why those same school children can show callous disregard for the lives of innocent civilians, we need look no further than the leaders of our own government, who spend billions of dollars, as Ramsey just pointed out, who spend billions of dollars to amass an arsenal of bombs and guns and weapons, and who show massive disregard for innocent lives in Iraq, in Belgrade, in Sudan, in Afghanistan, in the dozens of countries that we have bombed since World War II. Indeed, how can we teach our children nonviolence until we confront our own government, the largest purveyor of violence in the world today? I will tell you why we are here today. We are here because we are the people who support the rule of law over the rule of force. We are here today because we are the people who support human rights and human life. We are here today because we are the people who work night and day to build a 21st century which is not only safe for our children, but worthy of them. And we are not going away. We are not going away. We are not going away until this war on the people of Yugoslavia stops, which means rebuilding what we have destroyed. We are not going away until the war on the people of Iraq stops. We are not going away until our government stops forever and ever to wage war against civilian populations and to use cluster bombs and cruise missiles as idle playthings tossed capriciously at innocent people by a government which is bereft of meaning and direction and morality. We are not going away!
Gordon Clark, the executive director of Peace Action, one of the many speakers at the major demonstration in Washington, D.C. this weekend outside of the Pentagon. The website of Peace Action is www.peace-action.org. That's www.peace-action.org. And of the previous speaker, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, his website at the International Action Center is www.iacenter.org. That's www.iacenter.org. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back with Democracy Now! In just a minute and get the latest on the election in Indonesia. Stay with us.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough. To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and today we go to Indonesia. First, a look at the leading paragraphs of Reuters, Associated Press, and New York Times on the elections today. Reuters says Indonesians voted today in their first truly free election in 44 years and are expected to bury decades of autocratic rule and set the country on what is likely to be an uneasy transition toward democracy. The Associated Press says, from the dense jungles of Irian Jaya to the rebellious province of Aceh, Indonesians got their first real taste of democracy since 1955 as they voted today for a new parliament. And in the New York Times, the world's fourth most populous country, freed from the grip of its longtime dictator, marked a new era of political freedom today with its first free election in four decades. Today, we go to Jakarta, Indonesia, where we're joined by Ellen Nairn, freelance journalist and activist, just wrote a piece in The Nation magazine of May 31st called License to Kill. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ellen.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, can you give us your description of what is happening today in Indonesia?
Well, Indonesia does have a chance for democracy, but this election is not the means to get there. Indonesians don't really have a choice in this election if they want to vote against the army, if they want to vote against the military police state that is still intact, even though Suharto is gone. The three main opposition figures, Megawati Sukarno, Amin Rais, and Gus Dur, don't really seriously propose to break the army's hold on power. In fact, Golkar, Suharto's old party, if you look at their positions on paper, they actually are stronger, speak more strongly against the army, saying that the doctrine of dual function, which means the army runs both politics and security, they have a stronger position on that than does Megawati, the front runner. She says she wants to continue the dual function for at least 5 years. Megawati says she opposes the upcoming UN supervised vote, which will give East Timor a chance for independence. Golkar Suharto's party has endorsed it. Megawati has made it clear that she is very reluctant to put Suharto on trial. Golkar leaders say, go ahead, put him on trial. Now, you know, the Golkar positions are fairly meaningless, but the fact that Megawati, who really does have broad popular support, the fact that she takes those positions to the right of Suharto's old party indicates, you know, just how there really is no genuine option for someone who wants to vote against the army. So in a way, this election it's really secondary. It's really a sideshow. The real chance to break the army power in Indonesia will be in the coming months, as presumably the activist demonstrations resume. And people continue to put the army on the defensive over its continuing massacres in Aceh, the militia terror in Timor, their looting of the national economy, all the other things that have had people demonstrating almost nonstop for the past year. But that's where the real battle for democracy will take place. This election is really very minor in terms of the prospects for democracy in Indonesia.
Can you talk, though, about the three major candidates and what the process is that comes out of today's vote? I mean, they're not going to have a new president tomorrow.
No, this is just the first step of a very complicated bargaining process. They will choose some of the members of an assembly, a popular assembly, which will eventually choose the new president in the fall. And there will be intensive back-and-forth bargaining. In fact, the new president may even be someone who is not yet declared as a candidate. The latest name being floated by the Indonesian establishment is General Wiranto, the army commander. The army actually has reserve seats in the assembly that they don't have to stand for election for. So, you know, they'll be right in the thick of the bargaining. So it'll be a long process of deal making among the army and the rich of Indonesia, and a new president will be produced. I mean, Megawati is the most likely candidate, but in a way, it almost doesn't matter which one of these figures comes forward, because even if you had a truly reformist candidate who wanted to redistribute wealth in Indonesia, who wanted to stop the practice of political terror, they wouldn't be able to do that as long as the current army structure remains in place. The army has people down to the village level. They still have a series of laws which essentially make it a crime to be a dissenter. And you can't have democracy with that kind of system. So the question is, can that system be broken? None of the candidates have any interest in breaking it, but there's a large popular movement that does, and they'll be fighting that battle over the coming year. And I think the second big determinant on whether they win is how much international support can be cut away from the army, mainly from the U.S., which has always been their lifeline. The U.S. is still counting on the army as their main policy, the mainstay of their policy in Indonesia. This year they're sending in $106 million worth of weapons. There are all sorts of behind-the-scenes activities going on with Washington in overt and covert ways, trying to keep this army in power. But if enough people can mobilize here in the States, as these Timor Action Network has been successful in doing on the issue of self-determination for Timor, and if further cuts of the support for that army can be won here, then there is a real chance for democracy in Indonesia, because each cut really stings that army. They see Washington as their ultimate sponsor. For example, when the JSET program was ended last year, this is a program that sent in Green Berets and Air Force commandos to teach sniper technique and urban warfare and psychological operations to the Indonesian army. When that was ended or suspended last spring, after congressional and public pressure, it really shook the army, because at that moment the army was facing mass demonstrations in the streets. They felt that their support from their sponsor in Washington was weakening. It made them uncertain. And army officers here have told me that they feel those kind of cuts actually contributed to the downfall of Suharto, because it weakened the army's will. And I think that's probably true.
We're talking to Alan Nairn in Indonesia. Alan, we're speaking to you from Wall Street, our new offices at Pacifica Station WBAI. And there's a report from Reuters saying Wall Street wants a clear victory for the opposition in Indonesia's general election, though a messy government coalition is the more likely outcome. And it quotes a J.P. Morgan analyst saying the best result would be a majority vote for the opposition, not because I think the Golkar party would be bad, but because there's already too much hope in the population for an end to this 44-year-old regime. They're afraid that riots could be sparked if the Golkar party, the ruling party, won.
That's probably true. Many people I've met who have said that. Today I was at a polling place in a working-class Islamic district in Jakarta, and the way it works is after 2 p.m. when the polls close, the ballot, the boxes are opened and the votes are counted. And then the votes are read off one by one. So they'll say, you know, vote for Megawati, vote for Golkar. And every time a vote for Golkar was read out, the crowd, which is basically, you know, half of the neighborhood's voters who were sitting there watching, they all booed and hissed. When Golkar people tried to go out and campaign earlier this year, they found their banners being ripped down. They were often stoned. Spat upon. You know, people hate the Golkar because it's the symbol of the old Suharto regime. And if the Golkar wins, I mean, many people have said this, there may be something like an uprising. And it's still possible that the Golkar could do well, because it's a very convoluted, corrupt system. And in many rural areas, if you want to get your school fees paid to put your child in elementary school, if you want to get a job, if you want to get a permit, if you don't want to get your business shaken down, if you want to get some extra rice, if you want some cooking oil, if you want any number of favors, you've got to join Gold Car, and you've got to support them. And that political machine is still to an important extent in place. But to the extent that they have any choice over it, you know, there's this rising public sentiment where people want that gone. And what you see in its place is that there is this tremendous sentiment for Megawati. Just millions of people have poured into the streets. I think it's very naive. People follow her because of the myth of her father, Sukarno, the founding president of Indonesia, a nationalist whose regime, while occasionally repressive, was mild compared to the mass murder of Suharto. And he still has a tremendous popular affection, and his daughter is riding that. She's seen as clean because she's not rich. She and her family have lived off owning a few gas stations. They weren't on the Suharto gravy train. And for those reasons, and because they see her as, in some sense, opposed to Suharto, people are rallying around her, but they're going to be badly disappointed. Her Megawati's right-hand man is General Teo Shafei, former army commander in Timor, who's one of the more bloodthirsty officers. He's the commander who took over in Timor right after the 1991 Dili massacre. And his first comment was to say, well, if that demonstration had taken place under my command, there would have been even more casualties. And this is the man who is now the right hand of Megawati. There's a whole other coterie of army officers who surround her. Goose Doer and Amin Rais, the other two leading opposition candidates, are both very close to other military officers, including General Benny Mordani, the longtime intelligence chief, the man responsible for the Tanjung Priok massacre, the Timor invasion. You know, opposition politics here in the form of these establishment politicians does not offer a chance for democracy at this point. But Indonesia does have a chance for democracy if the street demonstrations can continue, if the army can be can still be forced to give ground, and if the legs of that army can be cut out from under them by continuing cutbacks of U.S. aid. There are bills in the Congress now. There's one offered by Representative Chris Smith that would definitively ban U.S. military training for regimes like Indonesia. There are other initiatives to cut off spare parts and weapons and ammunition backed by Representative Kennedy, Representative McKinney, and others. Each of these, and right now the East Timor Action Network is doing lobby days in Washington where more than 60 activists are there pounding the pavement. These legislative actions have tremendous impact on the army. You know, I've been, even though I'm here illegally, I have been able to talk to a number of army officers, and you know, they make it clear that whenever one of their U.S. props is knocked away, it really makes them nervous. They are uncertain about their future. They don't know whether they will survive this coming year as a dominant power in Indonesia because they know they're facing a continuing popular challenge. And this election is really a very it's almost a diversion. It's really a sideshow from it. Unfortunately, the election has drained away a lot of activist energy. A lot of that.
We have 10 seconds, Alan.
Which has poured in millions of dollars, and a lot of activists are wasting their time on election monitoring and voter education for an election where there's no real policy choice, instead of being out in the streets challenging the army like they were a few months ago. But I think that will resume soon. I think if Megawati becomes president, or Rais, or Gus Dur, or whoever, disappointment will set in quickly as they fail to shake up the military. And I think, you know, once again, the battle will be on in the streets. And that's where you know, the future politics of.
Alan Nairn, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Alan Nairn speaking to us from Indonesia, where he was deported from last year and threatened with 6 years in prison. That does it for today's show. If you want a copy, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Freedom.